Chapter 4. Though estranged from Bin Baz and the senior Saudi ulema, Juhayman found plenty of eager recruits among a younger generation. Displaced by the country's breakneck modernization, many of these men hailed from similar Bedouin backgrounds and, lured by the post-1973 economic boom, flocked from the deserts to the shining lights of Riyadh. Weaving a network among fellow Utebi tribesmen, National Guard veterans, and students of Islam, Juhayman assembled a secretive organization that numbered hundreds of members. This group of starry-eyed Muslim idealists sought to follow God's word to the letter, adopting short-cut robes, shunning material luxuries, and forswearing any use of photographs and other graven images. Eerily similar to hippies in the West, they let their hair and beards grow unchecked. They blotted out with black ink the king's portraits on the banknotes that passed through their hands. Considering the Saudi state to be illegitimate, they also destroyed their government-issue identity cards, which are mandatory to carry in the kingdom. Among the Saudis, none had passports for travel abroad. Though many adepts had their own homes, Juhayman established communal-style quarters in cities such as Riyadh, Medina, and Mecca. There, the movement's men could eat and sleep on the cheap, praying and studying Islamic religion together. Proselytizing, preferably away from the ears of the senior ulema, remained the main goal. Hosemi, the youngster who had met Juhayman during the 1976 Hajj in Mecca, rose through the ranks of the group as he continued crisscrossing the country and spreading the former corporal's teachings. University campuses in Medina, Mecca, and Riyadh at the time overflowed with foreign students, brought to Saudi Arabia on generous government stipends and indoctrinated in the spirit of Wahhabi Islam. Muslim Brotherhood sympathizers abounded among Egyptians and Syrians. They, like many young Yemenis and Kuwaitis, eagerly embraced Juhayman's creed. The Saudi kingdom, which would end up overseeing a large share of Islamic activities in the United States, in those years also began its outreach to the American Muslim community, then almost exclusively black. The Nation of Islam, a movement that mixed vaguely Islamic precepts with black racism, had been started in 1930 by a Detroit preacher who went by the name of Master W. Fard Muhammad. That group, seen as heretical by mainstream Muslims, believed that the white race had been created by evil scientists and that American blacks should separate themselves from the rest of the country into a state of their own. Ironically, Master Muhammad, of partial Polynesian descent, appears to have had no African blood himself. He was classified in U.S. law enforcement records as Caucasian. In the 1960s, as America went through a paroxysm of racial violence, Malcolm X became national spokesman for the Nation of Islam. In 1964, he met an Egyptian-born Saudi representative in New York. On the man's urging, later that year Malcolm X traveled to Mecca for the Hajj. This was a life-changing experience. Treated as a state guest by one of King Faisal's sons, Malcolm X, unaware that just 2 years earlier Africans had still been legally enslaved in the kingdom, was rendered speechless and spellbound by Saudi Arabia. The kingdom was infused with a spirit of unity and brotherhood that my experiences in America had led me to believe never could exist between the white and non-white, he wrote in his autobiography. Paving the way for tens of thousands of other American blacks, he abandoned the Nation of Islam for the mainstream Muslim faith, made even more appealing by anti-American feelings already prevalent in the Middle East. The American passport, Malcolm X wrote, signified the exact opposite of what Islam stands for. In 1975, after the death of the Nation of Islam's leader, Elijah Muhammad, his son and successor, Wallace, also embraced Saudi-style Islamic orthodoxy. Hundreds of black radicals, including former Black Panthers, flocked to Saudi-funded Islamic academies in the United States and in the kingdom itself. African-American students in Mecca in 1978 and 1979 included such prominent converts as Imam Siraj Wahhaj, who 13 years later would become the first Muslim clergyman to lead a prayer before the start of a session of the U.S. House of Representatives. Some of these first-generation Muslims were easily swayed by Juhayman's radical ideas, joining his group. Several supplemented their income by teaching the militants the arts of karate and kung fu. Others brought with them even more useful martial skills of urban guerrilla warfare that they had learned in the ranks of the Black Panthers, stateside. In the Saudi universities, Juhayman managed to draw an especially devoted following on the campus of the Imam Muhammad bin Saad Islamic University of Riyadh. The school, which focuses on preparing clerics and religious judges, has long been the ground central of Wahhabi hardliners, many of them nostalgic for the Ikhwan. There, Juhayman developed close ties with a Saudi student in his early 20s named Muhammad Abdullah Al-Qathani. With an unusually fair skin, long straight hair, and honey-colored eyes, Muhammad Abdullah hailed from a small Bedouin settlement in the southern province of Asir, one of the poorest parts of Saudi Arabia, and home to many of the hijackers who would participate in the September 11th attacks of 2001. Sensitive and shy, Muhammad Abdullah was given to dreamy silences and wrote passionate poetry in flowery classical Arabic. Unlike Juhayman, who had attended religious lectures without ever passing exams, Muhammad Abdullah was a full-time student who was nearing the completion of a four-year degree. Like many members of the new movement, Muhammad Abdullah had reasons to dislike the Saudi state. By one account, prior to enrolling in university, he was employed as an administrative worker in a Riyadh hospital. Suspicion fell on Muhammad Abdullah when money disappeared from the hospital safe. Saudi police, whose main investigative technique tends to be torture, pulled the young man's fingernails until he confessed to the crime. He was cleared and released from jail only after the real culprit was accidentally caught with the stolen cash later. Settling in Riyadh's conservative Manfua neighborhood, an area of squat cinder-block houses peopled by many recent arrivals from the desert, Muhammad Abdullah often delivered sermons in the local Ruwil Mosque. His two brothers, Saeed and Saad, were frequently in attendance. The young student seemed very special. Something about the way he looked and talked made people think that the pale-skinned Muhammad Abdullah had been singled out by God. Neighbors agreed that he was destined to become a great man of Islam, and they often offered him food and gifts. The mosque attracted crowds of youngsters eager for more religious education. Muhammad Abdullah, like other followers of Juhayman, charted a new path. He often refused to accept established clerics' religious rulings without first seeing the evidence. But why is it so? He frequently argued. Where is it written in the hadith? The science of hadith, of course, is extremely complicated. There are thousands of hadith narratives recounting Prophet Muhammad's examples and words, all written down much later and grouped in four categories according to the reliability of the chain of narrators: genuine, fair, weak, and fabricated. It takes years of assiduous scholarship to navigate this maze, scholarship that Muhammad Abdullah, who now often disappeared in the library to research old hadith collections, simply didn't possess. Establishment clerics have long discouraged such independent research. They felt that only the learned ulama could interpret hadith, placing every saying of the Prophet in its appropriate context. Turning to these primary sources without supervision was a challenge to authority, a step down the slippery slope. By early 1978, as his movement gained momentum, Juhayman felt that he had to publish his own writings, reaching out to new audiences and making sure that his ideas were not being distorted. There was, of course, no hope that the tightly controlled Saudi presses would agree to print such inflammatory literature. Instead, Juhayman turned his sights north, to Kuwait. Juhayman's representatives smuggled their teacher's manuscript across the porous desert border. There, they were introduced to the local publishing industry by a helpful Kuwaiti Muslim Brotherhood activist who would later become one of the emirate's most prominent Islamist politicians. Al-Kabas, Kuwait's leading newspaper, asked for an astronomical sum. Other commercial printing presses refused to touch the material, fearful of jeopardizing their Saudi business partnerships. The only willing partner was a small press named Dar al-Taliyah, or House of the Vanguard. This was no ordinary publisher. Dar al-Taliyah was affiliated with Iraqi-backed Saudi dissidents and propagated the nationalist ideology of Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Arab Socialist Party. The secularist and often Shiite militants of Dar al-Taliyah had virtually nothing in common with Juhayman's aggressive strain of Wahhabi-inspired Sunni fundamentalism, except, of course, their hatred of the Saudi royal family. Acting on the principle that my enemy's enemy is my friend, Dar al-Taliyah sent back a message that it would publish Juhayman's work, charging only its own printing costs. Soon, a 170-page green-and-white booklet titled The Seven Epistles was being smuggled back into Saudi Arabia. Only four of the seven chapters, the ones with the most political content, were signed by Juhayman himself. One carried the name of Muhammad Abdullah. The authors of the two remaining chapters identified themselves only as a student of the teacher. Saudi authorities, already alerted by some of Medina's official clerics about the rebellious nature of Juhayman's clandestine network, now had the incontrovertible proof. It was time to act. In late spring of 1978, shortly after the illicit book rolled off the presses, Hosseini, the young missionary, rested in Juhayman's modest home. The house, in the Hara Shakia neighborhood of Medina, did not possess such temptations as television or radio. An electric light bulb was the single concession to modernity. Women's quarters were strictly separated upstairs. Even his closest friends did not know the names of Juhayman's wives, let alone ever engage them in conversation. As a precaution, a hidden back door was in place to facilitate escape in times of trouble. And trouble was at hand. One night, an agitated local post office worker knocked on the door. He was a member of Juhayman's Utebi tribe, possibly a distant relative. Following Bedouin tribal codes of honor that require protection of fellow kinsmen from authority, he came with a warning. A telegram had just arrived, with government orders to arrest scores of men. Juhayman's name, the tribesmen had noticed, was on the top of the list. "Come with me," Juhayman ordered Hosseini after hearing the news. The youngster agreed without hesitation. Picking up a small bag, the two raced out through the back door. After scrambling into a battered pickup truck, they sped off north to the desert, away from people and roads. For 7 days, Juhayman used his Bedouin tracking skills to navigate by the stars, moving through the emptiness. The two fugitives fed themselves with a few dates and the meat of an antelope Juhayman had managed to shoot. On the 7th day, the pickup arrived at an isolated hamlet, home of one of Juhayman's trusted men. Juhayman and Hosseini stayed there for another 5 days while a messenger was dispatched to the oasis north of Riyadh, in the Otebi's tribal homeland near Sajir, to find out the precise details of the government crackdown. The picture was gloomy. On the orders of Prince Nayef, the powerful Minister of Interior and a full brother of Crown Prince Fahd, some 25 of the most senior members of Juhayman's network had been arrested. The detainees included Muhammad Abdullah, the fair-skinned poet student in Riyadh. The movement seemed all but crushed. A sympathizer in the security services provided Juhayman with a list of all those who were still sought for arrest. After glancing at the paper, Juhayman summoned a tense Hosseini. "Your name is not here. You have nothing to fear. Go home to Riyadh." In the following days, Juhayman used all his energies to reach the only man who could help, his former teacher, the blind cleric Bin Baz. As a supervisor of the Saudi judiciary and the interpreter of Sharia, or Islamic law, Bin Baz now possessed an authority that the royal family could hardly ignore, especially in this kind of affair. Juhayman still had the ear of clerics in Medina and Riyadh, who had defended him in the debate with the older ulema. Contacted by them, Bin Baz took interest in the case. After a conversation with Prince Nayef, Bin Baz insisted on personally questioning the young poet Muhammad Abdullah and others among Juhayman's arrested followers. The investigation did not take long. From the standpoint of Wahhabi theology, Bin Baz could find no reason for punishing the detainees. True, the devout youngsters may have used intemperate language against al-Saud and against Bin Baz himself, but they seem to have had the best of intentions in upholding public morals and spreading the true faith. All they wanted was to make the country more pious. What was the harm? After a few days, Bin Baz recommended that all the detainees be released. His words usually carried great weight. One Saudi businessman witnessed this influence while sitting in Prince Nayef's office in that period. As the ministerial telephone rang, Prince Nayef picked up the heavy receiver. Suddenly, he straightened his back and listened attentively, uttering,
Yes, sir. Yes, sir, between ornate expressions of respect.
The businessman thought that the interlocutor was King Khalid or Crown Prince Fahd, but didn't dare to ask.
Then, after carefully hanging up with both hands, Nayef punched a phone number and angrily rolled off the names of students at the Islamic University of Medina who had been detained by police.
I have just spoken with Sheikh Abdulaziz, Bin Baz. Prince Nayef barked instructions to an aide. You must free these men immediately.
Bin Baz's advice to Prince Nayef appears to have been followed with equal speed in the case of Juhayman's supporters. All the men were released forthwith, free to continue their work in the path of Allah.
A year and a half later, chastened by the Grand Mosque debacle, Crown Prince Fahd recalled this decision with palpable regret. We had earlier taken action against them, but some people intervened for their release out of good intentions, Saudi Arabia's de facto ruler mused. Those who interfered believed that perhaps they were something useful for the propagation of Islam.
Energized by the support from the ulema, and radicalized by the beatings they suffered in Prince Nayef's jails, Juhayman's militants emerged from their ordeal with a strengthened faith.
The miraculous rescue must have been God's divine work. In the following months, the movement ballooned, drawing in new adepts across Saudi Arabia, in Kuwait, and farther away.
In Egypt in particular, Juhayman's ideas found fertile ground. There, after Nasser's death in 1970, President believer Anwar Sadat switched alliances from Moscow to Washington and, wrapping himself in the mantle of Islam, hastened to release imprisoned Muslim Brotherhood activists.
Just as was the case with American diplomats and spies, he considered Islamic radicals far preferable to pro-Soviet leftists. As in Saudi Arabia, a religious revival, partially inspired from above, swept Egypt's university campuses. It became fashionable for young men to grow beards and for female students to wear Islamic veils. This embrace of piety was remarkably similar to the Saudi missionary movement that had been started by Bin Baz at the University of Medina. And, just like in Saudi Arabia, it soon spun out of control.
Paralleling Juhayman's split from Bin Baz, radical Egyptian students and graduates moved away from the mainstream Muslim Brotherhood, creating a web of secretive cells all over the country. That loose network, especially strong on the campus of Cairo University, became known as Gamat Islamiyah, or Islamic groups. Using intimidation and outright violence, its activists attacked leftists and enforced Islamic morality. Like Juhayman, they demanded a ban on art shows and secular cultural events and insisted on strict segregation between women and men. Little by little, they started accumulating firearms that, in following years, would drench Egypt in blood.
Sadat's 1977 surprise trip to Jerusalem, which paved the way for Egypt's American-sponsored peace talks with Israel, further radicalized the young firebrands. As the Saudi Ikhwan had done in the 1920s, they embraced the practice of takfir, declaring fellow Muslims with whom they disagreed to be apostates who could be killed at will. No longer a president believer, Sadat, reviled in clandestine leaflets as a new pharaoh who had deserted Islam, was now seen as a prime candidate for such an unnatural death. An even more secretive offshoot of Gamat Islamiyah, the Islamic Jihad, set to work on assassination plans. Prominent among these militants was a recent graduate from Cairo University's Department of Medicine, Ayman al-Zawahiri.
He and others shared their thoughts on the clandestine reading groups that developed on campus and in the mosques. Juhayman's The Seven Epistles, smuggled from Kuwait, was by then widely circulated and admired in that milieu. Egyptian radicals were in total agreement with Juhayman that the current rulers of the Arab world, be it the Egyptian president or the Saudi king, were no longer legitimate because of their failure to defend the true faith and to stand up to the West. In 1979, a magazine affiliated with the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood and widely read by Gamat Islamiyah supporters, Al-Dawa, even dedicated an issue to how the Saudi kingdom was supposedly succumbing to decadence and vice. The article's target, just as Juhayman's, or for that matter Bin Baz's, was Saudi television and radio.
Where is Saudi Arabia heading? The magazine wondered, enumerating recent outrages. In one TV series, it complained,
a female hero had been shown planting a kiss on a man who was not her husband. On a recent radio program, male and female anchors exchanged sweet words on air while it was clear that the doors behind them had been closed. Even Saudi taxi drivers had started misbehaving, no doubt influenced by American movies. All in all, the magazine complained, Saudi children, instead of dedicating their lives to Islam, now chose as role models the American $6 Million Man and Superman, Steve Austin.
Such infidel contamination in Saudi Arabia or Egypt was condemned with particular eloquence by Mohammed Elias, a popular cleric in his 30s who taught Islam to Gamat Islamiyah members at Cairo University. Elias was especially touched by Juhayman's writings. At first, he merely repeated Juhayman's ultra-conservative views in his own sermons, which were taped and distributed illegally across Egypt. Then, in 1979, Elias began planning a trip to Saudi Arabia to meet this inspiring new guru.
Chapter 5.
Like most Saudis at the time, Juhayman was vaguely aware of the Islamic revolutionary movements that were gathering strength around the region, including the Gamat Islamiyah in Egypt and the religious revival that steadily sapped the Shah's secular monarchy in nearby Iran.
But these foreign developments exerted only limited influence on his thinking. Juhayman definitely never watched TV and rarely browsed newspapers. Whatever happened in Iran, he thought, didn't deserve much attention because the Iranians were Shiites, incorrigibly stuck in their miscreant beliefs.
Raised on Wahhabi tradition, Juhayman was trained to look for all answers in Islam's glorious past, in the actions of Prophet Muhammad and his righteous companions.
So, as Juhayman contemplated his movement's next steps, he burrowed deeper and deeper into the big, dusty volumes of the Hadith. There, he stumbled upon a powerful concept of Islamic theology that seemed just right for these turbulent times, the Mahdi. The idea of a Mahdi has fueled Muslim imagination for centuries. There is no mention of it in the Quran itself. But Prophet Muhammad, according to some narrators, had forecast that God will one day dispatch a Redeemer, a Mahdi, to command the Muslim world and establish an ideal society after an apocalyptic clash with the forces of evil. This Mahdi cannot be killed by mere mortals, at least not during the first 7 years of his reign. In that time he will fill the earth with peace and justice, as it will have been filled with injustice and tyranny before then, the prophecy says. Shiite Muslims believe the Mahdi had already emerged in the 9th century, and then vanished to return at the end of the world. Several claimants to the status of Mahdi appeared among the Sunnis in the meantime, including the Sudanese rebel Muhammad Ahmed Sayyid Abdullah, whose followers routed the mighty British army and captured Khartoum in 1885, killing General Charles Gordon.
Juhayman dedicated to the Mahdi's imminent arrival one of the seven epistles. Before the promised Mahdi emerges, Juhayman noted in the text, great discord will occur, and Muslims will be drifting away from the religion, a condition that, to him, was already painfully obvious. Once revealed, Juhayman wrote, the Mahdi will become the only just ruler on earth. All true Muslims will pledge him bay'ah, the religious oath of allegiance, abandoning loyalty to their current presidents and kings. An army of the Mahdi's enemies will be swallowed into the opening ground between Medina and Mecca.
Then, the prophecy held, the hour will sound for the great showdown. The world's Christian empires, dead set in their arrogant ways and their hatred of the true faith, will dispatch a never-seen-before force to Arabia. 40,000 short of 1 million Christian soldiers will disembark, bringing their fearsome weapons and intent on desecrating the shrines of the Muslims and defeating God's servants. 1/3 of the assembled Muslim force will be stricken by fear and flee when confronted by Christians in the battlefield, Juhayman wrote, citing the Hadith. These men would be condemned to eternal damnation. Another 1/3 will be martyred, fertilizing the land with their precious blood. But the remaining 1/3 will triumph in battle, seizing all Christian cities with the cries of Allahu Akbar. The elimination of the Christian world will not be the end of events, however. That's precisely the moment when the devil will show his ugly hand, sending Dajjal, the Antichrist sorcerer and deceiver, to earth. To await his arrival, the Mahdi will first travel to the Al-Aqsa Mosque in East Jerusalem, restoring it to Islam. Like Moshe Dayan, the Israeli general who was defense minister in the 1967 conquest of East Jerusalem, the Antichrist will be missing one eye. And, in another reminder of the Arabs' current predicaments, he will be accompanied by an army of Jews, 70,000 of them. Overwhelmed by the Antichrist's powers, the Mahdi will flee to Damascus, where the Muslims will be besieged behind the city's thick walls, some hadith explained. In this trying hour, the Mahdi will kneel in prayer, and Jesus Christ will be returned to earth, carried by two white angels. Jesus, in Muslim tradition, is a prophet, but not a son of God. Much of Christian dogma is therefore viewed by Orthodox Muslims as a distortion of Jesus' true teachings. Appearing in front of the Mahdi and extending his comfort, Jesus will rejoice at the elimination of Christians and take over command in the battle against global evil. The Antichrist, or Dajjal, will be promptly slain by Jesus, who will stab him with a lance borrowed from one of the Muslims. The devil's envoy will dissolve like salt in water. After this, the Jews will be slaughtered, just like Christians had been, and the hour of redemption will finally sound. Not a single infidel will survive the breath of Jesus' air, Juhayman wrote longingly. The Hadith were fairly precise about the Mahdi's features and details of his coming. The Redeemer will look like Prophet Muhammad, with a broad forehead and a prominent nose, one narrative said. He will have a fair complexion and a large birthmark on his cheek. He will be tall, and, crucially, he will carry the same name as the Prophet and descend from the same tribe of Quraysh.
In due time, the Mahdi will receive the oath of Bay'ah on the holiest of grounds. Near the Kaaba in Mecca, between the C-shaped wall containing Hagar's and Ishmael's graves, the Rukn, and the boulder with the impression of Ibrahim's feet, the Maqam. Even the time was foretold in the prophecies, right after the Hajj, at the turn of a new Muslim century. In November 1978, after members of Juhayman's movement were released from jail, Hajj season arrived. In the calendar of Islam, year 1398 was turning to 1399. Juhayman summoned his men on a pilgrimage to Mecca's Grand Mosque, the place where the great revelation should happen. The world was 12 months away from the tumultuous events that would cover the mosque's marble courtyard with blood, spilled guts, and severed limbs.
On the long trip to Mecca from Riyadh, 500 miles away, Hosseini rode wrapped in a woolen blanket on the roof of a dented Mercedes sedan. Next to him, shielded by another blanket from howling winds that blasted the vehicle with sand, lay Muhammad Abdullah's younger brother, Saad. The two chit-chatted about the upcoming Hajj. Then, startling Hosseini, Saad blurted out, "Did you ever notice that my brother has all the features of a Mahdi?" "What do you mean?" "Well, he has the same name as the Prophet, Muhammad, son of Abdullah," Saad explained. "His brother was also fair and tall, and had a broad forehead, a prominent nose, and a big red mark on his cheek." Bouncing on the car's roof, Hosseini mulled over these words. But wasn't the Mahdi, according to the Hadith, also supposed to come from the same bloodline as the Prophet?
This was a clear contradiction. The Arab race comprises two branches. The Adnanis, who trace their lineage from Prophet Ibrahim's son Ishmael, and South Arabia's aboriginal Khatanis. How could Saad's brother, Muhammad Abdullah al-Khatani, possibly be a descendant of Prophet Muhammad if the Prophet's own tribe, the Quraysh, was of Adnani origin? Saad smiled. "You see, we're not really Khatanis," he confided. In the previous century, his great-grandparents had taken up residence on the lands of the Khatani tribe in what was now southern Saudi Arabia. Following Bedouin custom, they eventually adopted the tribe's name as their own, but the family's blood came from a very different source. Saad's ancestors, he said proudly, were actually Turks of noble origin who traced their lineage directly to Prophet Muhammad, and therefore to the Quraysh. In the days of the Ottoman Empire, the family lived for generations in Ottoman-ruled Egypt, and then was settled in Arabia by government officials eager to strengthen Ottoman control of the peninsula.
Hosseini remained unconvinced. The world outside Arabia was full of Muslims who claimed descent from Prophet Muhammad, often on fanciful grounds. The Bedouins of Saudi Arabia usually took such pretensions with a large pinch of salt, especially if this alleged lineage involved the inferior blood of Turks and other non-Arabs. By the time the Mercedes arrived in Mecca, Hosseini had put the whole conversation out of his mind.
After the Hajj, Juhayman started preparing for what he now believed would be an inevitable showdown with the kingdom's illegitimate rulers.
Almost permanently present in the Grand Mosque, his adepts began to pop up among crowds of worshippers, treating them to short, improvised sermons about the rigors of Islamic observance and the duty to fight unbelief.
They didn't just talk. The true believers, Juhayman now taught, had to prepare themselves for the worst. They should be able to defend themselves if the hypocritical Saudi state chose to strike God's servants again. The idea seemed right to everyone, especially those rattled by the beatings and the abuse they had received in jail. In small groups, Juhayman's followers took long desert trips, perfecting their marksmanship. There was no shortage of trainers. Many of the organization's Saudi members were, like Juhayman, fellow veterans of the National Guard. Much of that training appears to have happened on the remote bases of the Guard's tribal militias. Some of the weaponry that Juhayman accumulated, too, came brand new from Guard warehouses. Other guns and ammo had been smuggled across the border from Yemen, or from the battlefields of the Lebanese Civil War.
The kingdom, after all, was awash with military hardware. In 1978 alone, Saudi border patrols had seized 1,200 smuggled rifles, 481 machine guns, 7,358 pistols, and well over a million rounds of ammunition. Much more remained undetected. All proud Bedouin households in Saudi Arabia owned firearms, if not modern AK-47s, then at least ancient British-made bolt-action rifles.
In mid-1979, strange things started to happen in the tight-knit community of Juhayman's supporters. After a lull, the Saudi state renewed its crackdown, detaining militants who distributed Juhayman's booklet or collected money for the cause. Juhayman himself was again on the run, moving between desert farms owned by supporters. When visiting cities, he avoided arrest by staying right next to police stations, figuring that his pursuers would never look for him in such unlikely spots.
As more and more members, including Muhammad Abdullah's younger brother Saad, were thrown behind bars, the movement percolated with righteous passion and a burning desire to stand up to the perceived injustice of the Saudi regime.
Then, one after another, hundreds of Juhayman's supporters experienced detailed, vivid dreams. Muhammad Abdullah's sister appears to have been the first, quickly followed by others.
In their sleep, they all had the same vision. Muhammad Abdullah standing by the sacred Kaaba in Mecca's Grand Mosque, accepting allegiance as the Blessed Mahdi amid multitudes of believers. Militants from as far away as Lebanon, who had never encountered Muhammad Abdullah in person, claimed to have had the same dream.
Much of that dreaming must have been caused by self-suggestion, especially as Juhayman, increasingly obsessed with the coming of the Redeemer as the century neared its end, spoke more and more frequently about the divine signs that were supposed to herald the Mahdi's arrival.
Yet to most of the faithful, their nighttime experiences seemed a clear sign from God. In Islam, night dreams, especially when occurring collectively, are not easily dismissed as random stirrings of the unconscious. Prophet Muhammad himself received many of his revelations from God in the form of dreams, and attached great importance to these messages. The worst lie is that a person claims to have seen a dream which he has not seen, the Prophet is reported to have said. At first, Muhammad Abdullah, then barely 25, did not take all this seriously. He certainly did not advertise himself as a possible Mahdi. Juhayman, however, seemed deeply convinced that he had now found the Redeemer. Even the young man's hesitance was seen as a divine sign. The Hadith, after all, had foretold that the Blessed Mahdi would be reluctant to accept his new mission.
As the year ran its course, Juhayman sent more and more acolytes to whisper into Muhammad Abdullah's ear, convincing the young student that he was the chosen one. Shortly before the last Hajj of Islam's 14th century, Juhayman and Muhammad Abdullah grew virtually inseparable. One uncorroborated account, reported by a Western diplomat after the Grand Mosque takeover, alleged that the two even became homosexual lovers. In any case, they became family. Juhayman divorced his first wife and quietly married Muhammad Abdullah's sister, the one who had had the first dream of the young poet, as Mahdi. The dreams, it was decided in feverish meetings, called for forceful action. The believers, Juhayman said, would do God's duty by converging en masse on the Grand Mosque and fulfilling the prophecy. Casting for wider support, Juhayman in these weeks dispatched an emissary to bin Baz himself. At a meeting in Riyadh, the blind cleric listened patiently to the theological arguments, but he was not convinced.
First of all, bin Baz explained to the emissary, he refused to believe that Muhammad Abdullah indeed qualified as the Mahdi. A true Mahdi, bin Baz said, would spring up on his own, through God's will, without any need for human intervention. Any intrusion of the kind planned by Juhayman, bin Baz cautioned, had no chance of winning universal acceptance, and would result in the sin of provoking fitna, discord among Muslims.
The emissary did not mention that Juhayman planned to use weapons while anointing the Mahdi, and so bin Baz chose not to inform the authorities about this unsettling conversation. Soon after, Juhayman reclined in a circle of trusted adepts, sharing coffee and yellow dates in a large tent on a farm north of Riyadh. One of the followers present was Sultan al-Khamis, a teenage student who had been recruited into the movement while attending bin Baz's morning sermons at the capital's Faisal bin Turki Mosque. Juhayman was speaking frankly this time. The Mahdi had to be shielded from enemies of the true faith, and the onus was on the believers to provide this protection. On the appointed day, he said, the Grand Mosque will be seized at gunpoint and defended with arms. Khamis was puzzled. Didn't the Holy Quran and the Hadith specifically forbid fighting in the sacred precinct? He wondered. Juhayman grinned mischievously and responded by citing the Hadith about how the army of enemies of the Mahdi will be swallowed into the opening ground.
If we do not bring weapons, this army will not come to Mecca, he said, and so it will not be swallowed into the earth. In any case, he hurried to add, the weaponry will be purely defensive. We will not shoot until they shoot first. Chapter 6.
While Juhayman's clandestine network prepared for the Mahdi's arrival, Saudi princes grew concerned with more obvious perils. Chief among their preoccupations was the rapidly escalating turmoil across the Persian Gulf in Iran. For decades, the rulers of Riyadh had maintained cordial ties with the Shah of Iran, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, bound to him by a common interest of keeping revolutionary fervor and communist agitation away from the Gulf's warm waters.
Both monarchies prospered from oil and were crucial suppliers to America and the rest of what was then called the free world. And for decades, both royal households looked upon Washington to protect them from trouble. Washington had intervened in the past. In 1953, the Shah was forced to flee to Rome after a confrontation with his elected prime minister, Mohammad Mossadegh, who had expropriated Western oil interests and roused crowds with anti-Western oratory. Using their network of local agents, the CIA and British intelligence at the time organized a countercoup against Mossadegh. Codenamed Ajax, this covert operation culminated with the restoration of the Shah to the peacock throne of Tehran and Mossadegh's being thrown behind bars. In Saudi Arabia, America also had flexed its muscles. The U.S. Air Force flew protective patrols in Saudi skies in 1963 when Egyptian forces entered neighboring Yemen, clashing with Saudi-backed Yemeni royalists and encroaching upon the kingdom's own borders. But all this belonged to the past. Now, in 1979, America was just emerging from the trauma of Vietnam and had little appetite for foreign entanglements. The White House had been occupied since 1977 by Jimmy Carter, the former Democratic governor of Georgia, who was elected on a platform of America's moral rehabilitation and who could still boast that no American serviceman overseas had died on his watch. The U.S. military budget had been slashed. The CIA, tarnished by past involvement in assassinating foreign leaders and spying on American citizens,
was on a tight leash following congressional hearings. The agency had lost most of its ability to conduct covert action and found it nearly impossible to recruit new sources. For Carter's idealistic administration, curbing arms sales abroad and promoting human rights became foremost foreign policy goals. All this meant that the Shah was no longer viewed through the same prism of Cold War balance of power that had ensured him automatic American support in the past. When Islamist and leftist protesters started rioting against the Iranian monarchy in early 1978, the State Department's new Human Rights Bureau followed Washington's new set of priorities and blocked Iran's request to purchase tear gas, the same chemical that U.S. law enforcement agencies were using for crowd control at home. As 1978 progressed, student demonstrations, strikes, and clashes with police multiplied in Iran, encouraged by a spreading perception that America was no longer determined to support the Shah's regime. The Soviet Union's regional ambitions were encouraged, too. America barely reacted in April 1978, when communists carried out a coup and seized power in neighboring Afghanistan. Unrest in Iran escalated after Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, the dour 78-year-old Shiite scholar, until then living under tight supervision in Iraq, moved in October 1978 to the relative freedom of France. From the comforts of Neuf-le-Château near Paris, he assumed leadership of the anti-Shah movement's Islamist component. To Khomeini, the Shah represented a satanic government that flouted religion and could be only washed away in torrents of blood.
In December 1978, as Juhayman first shared his ideas about Muhammad Abdullah being the Mahdi in Mecca, the new Islamic year 1399 began. The first month of the calendar, Muharram has always been a period of mourning and religious fervor among the Shiites.
In Iran, these religious feelings were now harnessed by Khomeini, whose sermons, distributed via cassette tapes smuggled from France, inspired a crescendo of street clashes, protests, and strikes. The Carter administration, prodded by allies, faced a crucial dilemma. What to do next? The Secretary of State at the time was Cyrus Vance, an international lawyer who abhorred violence and believed in the strength of America's moral example. He and much of the State Department bureaucracy believed that promoting democracy and political compromise, rather than rescuing a lifelong ally, were America's ultimate goal in Iran. An overthrow of the Shah, the American ambassador in Tehran predicted optimistically, would lead to the creation of a benign, pro-Western government where Khomeini would play a Gandhi-like role. When the Shah inquired whether Washington would support a crackdown on increasingly more violent revolutionaries, U.S. officials responded by providing the Iranian monarch with ambiguous encouragements to move toward greater democracy. Carter's national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, was incensed by such policies. A Polish-born immigrant, he remembered all too well the perils of appeasement and argued that American policy in Iran was dangerously naive. "I simply had no faith in the quaint notion, favored by American lawyers of liberal bent, that the remedy to a revolutionary situation is to paste together a coalition of the contending parties, who, unlike domestic American politicians, are not motivated by a spirit of compromise, but, demonstrably in the Iranian case, by homicidal hatred," Brzezinski later wrote. Brzezinski's recipe was to organize a coup by Iran's pro-Western and American-trained military, something that he felt could quell the revolutionary fervor and stop the slide toward a radical anti-American theocracy. An American general was duly dispatched to Tehran on a mission to assist the Iranian military in retaining cohesion and, if need be, liaising for such a coup. But Vance and the vice president, Walter Mondale, were dead set against any American encouragement for projects to crush the Islamic Revolution. General Pinochet's American-supported putsch against democratically elected President Salvador Allende of Chile was still on everyone's minds and, as far as American public opinion was concerned, Pinochet seemed a much more evil figure than Khomeini. In the end, Carter decided to simply wash his hands of Iran. In a top-level policy meeting on January 3, 1979, he opined, "A genuinely non-aligned Iran need not be viewed as a U.S. setback." A few days later, the United States advised the Shah to leave the country. Carter, unaware that Iran's meltdown would doom his own presidency, went on repeating the same mantra, "We do not have any intention of interfering in the affairs of Iran."
the Iranian government disintegrated soon after the Shah departed. He eventually landed in the United States for cancer treatment. On February 1, 1979, Khomeini arrived in Tehran aboard a chartered French plane, greeted by millions of supporters who jammed the capital's streets.
"I beg God to cut off the hands of all evil foreigners and all their helpers," Khomeini urged in the airport, whipping up anti-American hysteria as the dark days of summary executions of counter-revolutionary suspects began.
Across the Atlantic, even hawks like Brzezinski failed to grasp that the region's upheaval heralded America's global clash with political Islam. "We should be careful not to overgeneralize the Iranian case," Brzezinski advised Carter a day after Khomeini's return. "Islamic revivalist movements are not sweeping the Middle East and are not likely to be the wave of the future." Other administration officials went as far as to cheer the Ayatollah. The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Andrew Young, that week, praised the vibrant cultural force of Islam and predicted that Khomeini will be somewhat of a saint when we get over the panic. Viewed from Riyadh, there was little reason for the panic to abate. The rise of an aggressive Shiite theocracy in Iran posed a direct threat to majority Sunni Saudi Arabia, reviving an age-old hostility between the two sects of Islam and undermining al-Saud's claim to leadership of the entire Muslim world. Apprehension over upheaval in Tehran was exacerbated by mounting threats all around the kingdom. In South Yemen, a Marxist regime took power and, with Soviet aid, was destabilizing Saudi allies in North Yemen. Across the Red Sea, Marxist Ethiopia was crawling with Cuban troops and massive amounts of Soviet military hardware, which it used to defeat the Saudis' regional ally, Somalia. Soviet military advisors also grew more and more numerous in Afghanistan. The delicate task of maintaining America's crucial relationship with Saudi Arabia at this juncture was entrusted to the 57-year-old ambassador, John Carl West. A jovial, bald Southern Democrat, he had been elected governor of South Carolina, running on the earnest slogan, "Elect a good man," when Carter himself became governor of neighboring Georgia. One of the first prominent Democrats to endorse Carter's presidential ambitions during the primaries, West had been long fascinated with the Arab world. So instead of settling for a comfortable ambassadorship somewhere in Europe, he specifically demanded a Saudi posting, until then usually occupied by a career diplomat, as his post-election reward. Though West knew precious little about the Middle East, his experience with clannish southern politics made a good introduction to navigating the convoluted relationships within the Saudi dynasty. The Wests entertained prominent Saudis as many as three times a day. Saudi royals, who put a premium on personal ties, reciprocated with access. They valued West's friendship with Carter and knew that the American ambassador frequently bypassed the State Department in his handwritten correspondence with the president. The Saudis by then were also fully aware of just how much influence they could exert over Washington. In mid-1979, as troubles in Iran disrupted global oil supplies, America was hit by gasoline shortages that made Carter's approval ratings plummet to a dismal 25%. Tempers flew as gas lines across the United States snarled traffic. On the first Sunday of summer, 1979, a staggering 70% of American gas stations closed down after running out of fuel. Begging for help, Carter that month had Ambassador West deliver to Saudi princes a personal handwritten message asking for an increase in oil production. The Saudis complied, bolstering output to 9.5 from 8.5 million barrels a day, and ensuring that American gas lines disappeared. They also made sure the American president didn't forget that he owed them a favor. "Prince Sultan the other day asked me if the increase in production had helped you politically," Ambassador West reported back to Carter in one of his handwritten notes in September 1979. With a twinkle, he remarked that a million barrels were worth at least a million votes, and, if so, the Saudis had done at least something to help with your re-election. What the Saudis wanted in exchange was an American security umbrella. In those days, America already provided some military hardware to the kingdom. The Carter administration had just pushed through Congress a controversial deal to supply the Saudi Air Force with sophisticated F-15 fighter jets. Hundreds of American soldiers were secretly stationed in the country. Since 1975, the Vanel Corporation, supervised by an American general, had run a comprehensive training program for the Saudi National Guard. Separately, another American military mission, also headed by a general, was based at the airfield of Tehran that the U.S. Air Force used from time to time. Saudi Arabia's key interlocutor with the United States on security affairs was Prince Turki Al-Faisal, the son of the assassinated King Faisal. Educated at Georgetown University and fluent in colloquial English, the taciturn, soft-spoken prince served from 1977 to 2001 as head of the Saudi General Intelligence Directorate, or GID, the kingdom's equivalent of the CIA. In response to Saudi requests, even the stunted CIA offered limited assistance to the kingdom. The agency's station chief in Saudi Arabia, George Cave, worked with Prince Turki on training the kingdom's anti-terrorism forces in the latest American techniques. American operatives were based at a special training center in Taif, a mountain town that offers relief from the scorching heat of Mecca, or Jeddah, and has long served as a summer retreat for Saudi royalty. The CIA shared its experience on the predictable topics in the age of international bombings and plane hijackings, sharpshooting, explosives handling, tear gas use, hostage rescue. At the end of one such session, Cave mentioned to Prince Turki that, according to the American rulebook, a psychiatrist should be on staff of the new Saudi hostage rescue team. "I'll get back to you on this," the prince responded pensively. The following day, Cave had a reply. Conditions in Saudi Arabia differed somewhat from America's. "We can't do this. We only have 3 psychiatrists in our entire country." The CIA, despite providing this limited security aid, saw little reason to worry about Saudi Arabia's overall stability. The agency, which found it extremely difficult to procure information in the tightly knit and pathologically secretive Saudi kingdom, had no inkling of Juhayman's agitation and discounted the Iranian threat. The modernization of the Arabian Peninsula may have heightened some tensions among local religious elements, although for now most appear under control, the CIA opined in its classified April 1979 assessment of Saudi Arabia and neighboring sheikdoms. The Shiites in Saudi Arabia are believed to have no particular affinity for Iranian political developments and appear to have gained enough economic ground in recent years to forestall any serious agitation, the document said. The limited help offered by the small CIA team and the training of the National Guard were by no means enough for the Saudi royals. What Riyadh desperately wanted was a dramatic display of the Carter administration's determination to protect its allies in the region from Khomeini's firebrands and the Soviet menace. Crown Prince Fahd impressed the Saudis' frustration on Ambassador West during a late-night meeting October 2, 1979, in his palace on Jeddah's Red Sea beach. As Fahd saw it, the Soviets, with their support for Khomeini and mischief from Ethiopia to Afghanistan, were making a push for controlling the Persian Gulf, while America manifested seeming indifference or impotence. Instead of pressuring the Shah into bringing his thoughts and actions up to date so as to pull the rug from under the communist agitators, you let him go, Fahd lamented. Look at what has happened in Iran. They have killed the cream of their society. The best brains in the military, the professions, and the civil service have all been executed or forced into exile. And after all this, Fahd continued, there had been not a word of caution to Iran from President Carter. After Afghanistan, Pakistan might be the next domino to fall, the Crown Prince predicted, explaining that most of the region, while forced to adopt the newly fashionable anti-American rhetoric in public, yearned for nothing more than a demonstration of American strength. 3/4 of the Arab regimes are with you, really, Fahd said. They all await, expect, and hope for their powerful, wise, and morally adroit friend, the U.S., to send out the message loud and clear, enough is enough. Taken aback, West argued that those who insinuated that the U.S. was not willing to come to the aid of its allies and friends were mistaken. The Crown Prince wouldn't relent. All he had received from the United States so far were vague words instead of a firm, unequivocal stand. The stakes for the kingdom were just too high, he explained, and the dangers seemed far more immediate from Riyadh than from Washington. To count the lashes is one thing, but to feel them is something else. A month after this conversation,
the whole world witnessed, instead of a show of American strength, the humiliating pictures of American weakness. On November 4, 1979, revolutionary students stormed the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, seizing 66 hostages, who were promptly blindfolded and paraded in front of the cameras. Iran's secular prime minister, Mehdi Bazargan, who had just met Brzezinski in Algeria trying to patch up Iran's relations with Washington, rushed to his office from the Tehran airport. Bazargan did his best to end the crisis, but Khomeini, by far the more powerful figure, opposed any negotiations with the Great Satan that had sheltered the Shah. He immediately endorsed the embassy's seizure. Within hours, Khomeini's son personally climbed over the compound's fence to join the hostage takers. Bazargan resigned in protest. Undivided power over Iran now belonged to the Ayatollah. The rest of the region watched, bewildered, as the Carter administration seemed to be taking in stride this ultimate insult, unprecedented in the history of modern diplomatic relations. At the first policy meeting the day after the embassy's seizure, Carter refused suggestions to threaten Iran with military action if the hostages were not released. The Iranians, he muttered, have us by the balls. Following standing orders, Marines at the embassy in Tehran had offered no resistance to the intruders. Not a single bullet was fired. The lack of preparedness for the embassy's takeover was staggering in retrospect. After all, just in February that year, a mob of Khomeini supporters had surrounded and tried to storm the very same building. Simultaneously, in neighboring Afghanistan, the American ambassador had been captured by Islamic militants and then shot dead in a botched rescue attempt. Weeks before the November 4th embassy takeover, the top officer at the CIA's Operations Directorate Middle East Division had flown to Saudi Arabia specifically to meet the Tehran station chief and warn him of likely trouble ahead. Once the revolutionary students overran the Tehran compound, they captured, along with American diplomats, one of the biggest treasure troves of classified information ever lost in history. These reams of secret U.S. correspondence would be published in Tehran in a 77-volume series called Documents from the U.S. Espionage Den. In a huge embarrassment to the Saudis, one of the documents in this collection was a copy of Ambassador West's secret cable reporting the frank exchange he had had with Crown Prince Fahd. Chapter 7. The fall of the American embassy in Iran coincided with the Hajj of 1979. Saudi royals were frightened that Khomeini's drive to export the Islamic Revolution might now prompt the Ayatollah to try some spectacular stunt in the Grand Mosque. Trying to buy its way out of trouble, Saudi Arabia even rushed emergency kerosene supplies to Iran in a goodwill gesture that alleviated crippling shortages there. As it happened, the Iranians caused little trouble in Mecca that year, beyond passing around Khomeini posters and leaflets that glorified their revolution. For now, the streets of Shiite towns in Saudi Arabia's eastern province remain quiet too. Hundreds of Juhayman's followers, from Saudi Arabia and abroad, converged on Mecca that season. They were a disparate lot. The hard core of Juhayman's kinsmen from Bedouin settlements in the Nejd was now complemented by scores of young students from all over the country, including the scions of some of Saudi Arabia's most prominent families, thoroughly infused with a messianic faith of their master. One was the son of a regional governor, a second the son of a Saudi ambassador, a third a teacher of English who had been educated in Britain. Many hailed from villages near Mecca itself. The numerous foreigners included at least two African-American converts and the Egyptian preacher, Muhammad Elias. For more than a month, the entire Muslim world, from Indonesia to Africa, had been rife with expectations that something extraordinary would happen in Mecca at the turn of this century. The pilgrim influx was unusually heavy. In October, Meccan clerics dutifully reported to senior ulema in Riyadh that, according to local rumor, the Mahdi was to appear to believers by the Kaaba after the Hajj. Coming soon after the Riyadh meeting between bin Baz and Juhayman's emissary, such a report should have raised alarms, but the ulema took no visible action in response. The Saudi secret police, the Mabakheth, also did not intervene. It is hard to imagine that the Mabakheth, with its thick network of informers, was completely unaware of Juhayman's plan to proclaim the Mahdi in the Grand Mosque. True,
Some Abakhet officers had been reached by Juhayman's followers in their homes and threatened with deadly retribution should they try to oppose the Mahdi's arrival. But the idea of anointing the Mahdi by the Kaaba was shared by then among so many people that it couldn't have been completely hidden from the watchful eyes of Prince Nayef.
Then again, the American FBI and CIA also possessed plenty of clues ahead of the September 11th attacks of 2001, and still failed to prevent them.
Only a narrow circle within Juhayman's movement was involved in highly secretive preparations for the actual armed uprising. In explaining his vision to senior aides, Juhayman carefully chose his words.
He never described his project as a violent occupation of Islam's Holy of Holies. The burgeoning weaponry stock, as he put it gently, was only needed to protect the Mahdi from evildoers. In any case, he predicted with a reassuring smile, it would all end peacefully. The entire Muslim world would quickly accept the Mahdi as its unchallenged leader.
Those who had experienced night dreams about the Mahdi enthusiastically followed Juhayman's instructions. There was no doubting for them. They believed by now that Muhammad Abdullah was the Redeemer, and that he should be anointed with the oath of allegiance by the sacred Kaaba, as prescribed by the Hadith. Even some of those who didn't fully share Juhayman's theological certitude agreed to take part. Mohammed Elias and fellow Egyptian jihadis in particular were impressed by the arsenal that Juhayman had managed to assemble. Mahdi or not, for them this was an uprising against a puppet regime of American infidels, and Juhayman seemed charismatic and well-connected enough to succeed, possibly even igniting the entire region in the flames of Islamic revolution. But other senior leaders, including a preacher who helped Juhayman write the seven epistles, remained highly skeptical. Torn between their obedience to Juhayman and the enormity of this venture to capture Islam's Holy of Holies, many of them quietly peeled away, without, however, informing authorities.
Among such doubters was Faisal Muhammad Faisal, one of the group's most senior members by both age and importance in the organization. A tall, balding man with gaunt cheeks and an aquiline nose, Faisal was in his 40s, about 2 decades older than Juhayman's average disciple. Long active in the Islamic missionary movement, he had studied religion together with a supposed Mahdi's older brother, Sayyid Abdullah. Despite Faisal's bitter experiences in Saudi jails during the brief government crackdown on the organization the previous year, he remained a relative moderate, opposing the penchant of some of Juhayman's adepts to practice takfir and label those with whom they disagreed as apostates.
In early November 1979, Faisal traveled south to the mountains near the town of Najran, where he had been born. Accompanied by his wife and children, Faisal stopped over at a farm owned by one of the movement's adepts in the settlement of Ammar, north of Riyadh. Juhayman was there as well, waiting for the Hajj season to end. After the usual courtesies, the two shared a meal of rice and lamb, using their right hands to dip balls of rice into the gravy. Then they got down to discussing Juhayman's ambitious plan.
Faisal admitted that he himself did not experience the dreams. Was seizing the Grand Mosque the right move? He wondered aloud. How can we be sure that Muhammad Abdullah is indeed the true Mahdi?
Certainty glowed in Juhayman's eyes as he dismissed Faisal's doubts. Wasn't it obvious that the end of days was near, with corruption flooding the world? Weren't the detailed, vibrant visions of the Mahdi that all other true believers seem to have nowadays a clear proof sent by God to mankind? Sensing that Faisal still wavered, Juhayman looked up with a steady gaze that often produced a near hypnotic effect on his followers. "Don't worry. The responsibility for this will be all mine," he said after a long pause. "Everything is on me." By the end of the day, Faisal's loyalty to Juhayman won over. He was to be counted in. "I will continue on my journey south," Faisal told Juhayman that day, "but once I deposit my wife and children in Najran, I will return north and join you in Mecca." As New Year's Day approached, Juhayman also garnered crucial support on the inside. Several among the conspirators studied in the Grand Mosque Academy and knew every nook and cranny of the compound. One, Nuruddin Sheikh Badiuddin, was the son of one of the Grand Mosque's most powerful clerics, the Pakistani-born Sheikh Badiuddin Insanullah Shah. some other senior clerics, while not actively supporting the conspiracy, chose to turn a blind eye to the unusual doings around them.
The Bin Laden Company, which had constructed much of the Grand Mosque anew since the expansion began in 1956, still had a few unfinished work sites in the compound. The company used for access an opening under the Fatah Gate on the northern side of the shrine. Connected with the streets of Mecca by a bridge over a dry moat, this doorless opening led into the Grand Mosque's maze of underground chambers, the Kabu.
For a modest bribe of 40,000 rials, members of the Grand Mosque's guard service allowed Juhayman and his aides to drive three pickup trucks, a Toyota, a Datsun, and a red GMC, through the Bin Laden accessway.
The trucks, parked in the shrine's basement with the consent of Bin Laden employees, were packed with weaponry, ammunition, and vital supplies of food.
In the last hours of Islam's year 1399, Juhayman and Muhammad Abdullah finally appeared in Mecca. The religious students, who usually live in the mosque's basement rooms, were given time off to return to their families for the celebrations, so the Kabu was free of most of its usual occupants. Juhayman and Muhammad Abdullah kept a vigil inside the Grand Mosque that night, lounging under its opulent porticos and talking in hushed voices with fellow conspirators.
Their soiled clothes and unwashed faces betrayed an unusual neglect of hygiene and attracted the unwelcome attention of outsiders. One neatly dressed Iranian pilgrim even berated Muhammad Abdullah for his unseemly appearance that night. "Dress is not important," the Saudi answered impatiently.